Good evening and good day if you are calling from faraway places, and I welcome you to this 15th session of the Afghan Association of Ontario Facebook Live program in awareness of racism, discrimination, Islamophobia, and all kinds of hatred. This is an initiative of the Afghan Association of Ontario in collaboration with and partial funding by the Government of Canada. And we want to create awareness in the mainstream Canadian society, as well as in the immigrant communities, about this triangle of evil, which is racism, discrimination, and hatred, and manifested in many different forms. We focus more on Islamophobia because this program is more directed towards the Muslim community in Canada. In this program, we invite people with experience and expertise in Islamophobia, and those who want to share their stories with our viewers. Today we have a respected imam, Sheikh Hussam Hilal, who is not only an imam, he's a chaplain, and he's also a manager for education of the youth at ISNA. Is that correct?
So I'm currently doing education lead and youth support.
So welcome to the program, and maybe we can start with a brief introduction. You can have your greetings to our viewers, as well as if you just talk for a minute or two about your experience here in Canada.
Yeah, assalamu alaikum. Peace and greetings upon all of you. Alhamdulillah, very happy to be here with my brother Ahmed Shah Durrani. May Allah bless him, Ya Rab, Ameen, and his family. And again, welcome to all of you. I ask God to allow this to be a beneficial conversation for all of us and a fruitful discussion. So my name is Hussam. I'm currently doing my doctoral studies in the intersection between evolutionary biology and tafsir, which is the Quranic commentary or exegetical, the exegetical tradition in Islam. Besides that, I do counseling. I do marriage support, divorce support, family support, youth counseling, and education development.
Go ahead. Sorry, there was a glitch.
Yeah, that's the basic intro.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. That is very interesting. Very interesting. And now I see why you are so busy. So it is good. I would like the viewers to share this program on their social media pages. This is an important program, especially today. We have a scholar with us, and we have a person who is not only a religious person, but he's also in contemporary sciences. He's a scholar in contemporary sciences also. And he deals with the different ages of people in his capacity, in his various capacities that he deals and serves the community. Sheikh Hussam, I will come straight to the thing. You are an imam, a chaplain, you are an education manager, and you deal with people of all ages, but especially the youth. In your encounters with them, do people talk about racism, Islamophobia, discrimination, and how often do you hear this about?
Yeah, so in the conversations that I have with young people and people of all ages, people tend to shy away from sharing their experiences about racism, Islamophobia. So they don't like to report it as much unless there is a reason. Let's say it's a conversation about racism or a conversation about Islamophobia. Then people begin to report their experiences, and you'd be surprised at the amount of, the many, many times where people actually experience racism, Islamophobia, hatred of all kinds, but they just don't speak about it until and unless they're prompted. And once they're prompted, like, this floodgate opens and people say, oh yeah, this happened with me and this happened with my children and this happened with my wife and this happened with my son and even my own personal experiences. There are just, again, many personal encounters with Islamophobia and hatred and racism. But I would like to imagine that we're slowly getting beyond the very explicit forms of racism, and now it's becoming more of the implicit, the systemic, which is still problematic, but at least it's not as manifest. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the manifest racism is better than the explicit racism, because it's better that someone explicitly mentions it than implicitly, you know, puts on this smile and face of acceptance and tolerance, but then, you know, through passive aggression or through implicit means, denies you access to resources, mm-hmm. denies you access to conversations, access to certain spaces or privileges simply because of, you know, what you wear or what you dress, how you dress, and the kind of philosophical commitment or religious commitment or worldview that you commit to, or the color of your pigment, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is a tragedy, but you pinpointed a few very important things, and I would like our viewers to know about it, is that perhaps there is also a stigma attached to, if people talk about that, you know, they have been discriminated against it. Perhaps some people might feel that they're not adequate enough, that the people look at them in that direction, so they don't talk about it. Similar to like people with mental health issues. They try to keep it to themselves. And this is very important. I was interviewing for this program two people who deal with immigrant communities from the law enforcement. And what they were saying was that, yes, it is quite widespread because they get all the reports from everywhere. Canada is a big country. And we, even if it happens every day, it happens in different parts. So we think it is very sporadic. But when all the information is collected in one place, you see that it is important. Statistics Canada, the issue, the reports on, you know, hate incidents. Mm-hmm. And this year they had published information that in the past 2 years, the reported incidents of hatred and discrimination, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and anti-other minorities had increased by average of 68%. Islamophobic incidents that were reported have increased by 72%. Anti-Semitic incidents, 68%. And anti-Catholic incidents by 64%. Mm. And I thought that Catholics were the mainstream, but apparently they are not. But I think perhaps somebody can do a research and perhaps write a PhD on it as to what is going on in that respect. Mm-hmm. But coming back to as an imam and a scholar dealing with many different and diverse Muslim communities. Mm-hmm. So you already pinpointed out how big is Islamophobia in a society such as Canada. I know that in some societies in Europe, for example, it's rampant. In some other countries which have less interactions with Muslim communities, perhaps it is rampant. But Canada is famous for being an open society, a tolerant society, a pluralistic society. In that regard, I would like, you know, your opinion on, first of all, how prevalent is here? And the second one is, compared to other countries around the world, especially of similar economic status, social status like Canada, compared to them, what will be our score in Canada?
Yeah. So the typical image that comes to mind when you think about the Canadian society is one of tolerance and acceptance. And I would like to imagine that there is a lot of that in Canada. Mm-hmm. But you cannot deny, factually speaking, that some of the biggest acts of hatred and crime and violence against Muslims took place in this country. You look at what happened, subhanAllah, in London. If you look at London, an entire family, right? If, you know, we're talking about generations this is homicide. This is a terrorist attack, right? If you look at what happened in the IMO Masjid here, just a few minutes away from us in Mississauga, the security guard of the Masjid getting killed, getting stabbed. If you look at what happened in Quebec, these are three different areas, and this is all within the same, you know, two, three year period. And this is very recent. We're not talking about 10 years ago. We're talking about in the last couple of years. So I think there is a lot of negative images and negative information that is spread online, that is cultivating, that is catalyzing, that is catapulting, you know, specific narratives of hatred and specific communities and groups of hatred, and pinning communities against each other. And I think that is definitely playing into it. If you look at the individuals that commit these acts, usually they like to be painted as lone wolves, or they like to be painted as people with mental health, you know, challenges. Mm-hmm. But if the same were to happen, you know, or take place by a Muslim, and may Allah protect him, and may Allah keep us all safe, ya Rabbi Ameen, it's not an us and them problem. It's we're in a community, a similar space, and we're trying to work through this together. But we have to identify the hypocrisy. If somebody were to commit this from the Muslim community, they would be called a terrorist right away. But if somebody from a non-Muslim community, that's where you begin to, you know, let's be a little bit more nuanced. Let's be a bit more careful with the language. Well, that in itself, the reporting bias itself speaks to the kind of implicit racism or Islamophobia that exists. And it's only very recently that we've had, you know, some organizations like the NCCM, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, step up and try to, you know, occupy that seat of advocacy for the community. But still, there is, without a doubt, rampant and clear, vivid hatred and vivid violence against Muslims. And these are not isolated incidents. You know, people like to think, oh, these are isolated incidents. The amount, like you've mentioned, the amount of things that go unreported, the amount of cases that go unresolved, unaddressed, and the amount of lack of attention from the police, from the, you know, authorities when it comes to this is actually insane. I'll give you just some examples. A few years ago, I was taking some children from the masjid. We're walking from the masjid to a nearby, stadium or a nearby soccer center. And as we're walking, this individual stops with their, you know, pickup truck, lowers the window, swears at these children, and in an act of aggression, drives fast enough, they almost hit one of the kids.
Wow.
When we called the police, they said, well, is he still on site? We're like, no. Did you catch the plates? People were too, you know, moving too quick to, or people were very busy, occupied to for anyone to catch the plates. And like, okay, we'll deal with it. We'll call you back. We never got a call back. That's an example, right?
Yeah.
And more recently, at one of the masajid in Mississauga, there was an individual who was, you know, walking around, you know, saying certain things like slurs and hatred and things that are very aggressive, and things that we understood to be threats. But when we called the force or the police, they came in and they said, well, you know, we don't have enough evidence. We don't have enough to actually, you know, issue a verdict or make an arrest. And of course, I understand there are specific protocols and systems in place. And, you know, everybody's trying to do the best that they can. And we're all working within specific systems and parameters. But this is, in sharing these examples, the message is very clear. These are not isolated incidents. We deal with this on a day-to-day basis. When you dress actively this way, you know, you get certain looks, you get certain eyes and gazes, and there are certain implicit and explicit assumptions that people make about you when you dress in a specific way, especially if you're visibly Muslim. When you wear the hijab or you wear the veil or you wear any item or article of clothing that identifies you as Muslim, there is a targeting that naturally comes, and there is a prejudice that is naturally, it's the gaze, the way that you're looked at, that is clearly told. But Muslim sisters who wear the veil, clearly experienced by Muslim men who, you know, dress or behave in a way that identifies them as Muslim. There is that unfortunate assumption and prejudice and bias that exists.
What they call it, unconscious bias. In some cases, it's conscious bias, but even those who you know, proclaim that they don't have any bias, there is the unconscious bias exists. In your opinion, what role can the community organizations, the religious organizations, the masajid can play? And here are the two different aspects of it. One of them is to prepare community members, the related community members. So if there is this kind of microaggression or passive aggressive, etc., that they are strong enough to resist it and not be affected by it negatively. And then the other way is working with the other side to enlighten the community so that these incidents become less. What do you think the role these institutions can play a role in?
So first thing is, every individual who experiences an act of hate, you know, hate crime or violence or a threat that is Islamophobic in nature or otherwise, should not shy away from reporting. You should report. You should, you know, call the specific authorities. And there is a specific number you call for hate, in hate crimes, and report it as a hate crime. So at least there is evidence and there are statistics in place to justify change on the policy level and to justify change on the institutional level. Because at the end of the day, if we're experiencing this and we're not reporting it, what's happening? You know, that is being lost. That entire experience is not being captured from a numerical and a statistical point of view. So that's number one. Don't be afraid to report. And imams need to make that messaging very clear from the minbar, from the pulpit. They need to make that message very clear from their interactions. And institutions and mosques and masajid need to also make that very clear. So that I think is number one. Number two, we have to also train our community to be able to respond well and not to be passive in dealing with this. You know, sometimes we're told to kind of just, you know, it's okay, things happen, it's expected, it's in this kind of space, it's okay. And that is normalizing the experience. So people go through like, it's okay, we're just immigrants, we're just here, we're guests. No, this is your home, this is your land as much as it is anybody else's land. You have the same claim as anybody else who, you know, is Canadian. Just because you you know, grew up somewhere else, or you came here as an immigrant, or you're born as a second generation, it doesn't take away your rights, nor does it take away your belongingness from this part of the world. So my message would be very clear to everybody in that space. You are fully entitled to the place that you're in, and you respect the rules of this land. Therefore, you have the rights that everybody has who are in who live in this part of the world. And then finally, the role the institutions play at large is in reaching out to advocates, reaching out to stakeholders who care about the things that we care about. There are a lot of allies out there, but they just don't know, or we haven't reached out to them, right? So reach out to the allies in the community. Let them know about your experience. Build relationships with your neighbors. Build relationships with the public community. Don't be self-isolated, because that feeds into the narrative that Muslims are this or Muslims are that. But when we put ourselves out there and we're very confident and comfortable in our skin, we hold on to being, you know, fully Muslim and fully embrace the good that comes with being a Canadian. It's very, you know, important to be present, in the public sphere through our volunteering, through our donations, through our philanthropy, through our community building, and not being limited only to our community. Because you see this happen. A lot of Muslims, they work with Muslims, they live with Muslims, they help Muslim causes, they volunteer only with Muslim organizations. And that's good that we're doing that, you know, as a community. But there needs to be a piece of reaching out, and that reaching out needs to be strategic and it needs to be organized as well. So not just an individual effort, but on a community level, identifying the stakeholders in our community and reaching out to them so that we're building this long-term relationship with them, and we're also creating and opening the channel of communication with them.
Well, if I may summarize what you just said in a few points, and just to emphasize so the viewers now and the viewers who will be looking at it on YouTube can get from it. One of the things that is important is that when an incident happens, don't accept it passively, and don't be overly aggressive also, but be assertive. Gather the information and then inform the authorities, the appropriate authorities, law enforcement people, that this incident happened. The more incidents are accurately reported and the more statistics become available, it affects government policies in various communities. So with the government policies are determined by how much statistical information is available for them. And if you don't report it, then the policies will be, implemented according to what the information at their disposal. The second thing, if I might also add my own spin to it, is that if we as community members are good ambassadors of what the real values that we hold, and we can present those values to the community, and the mainstream people become aware of, then the incidents of Islamophobia, or for that reason, anti-Semitism or anti-Sikhism or any other visible minorities that are, will be reduced, in my opinion. I will bring just a historical example that, Muslim traders and merchants acted as good ambassadors of Islam. Mm-hmm. In Indochina, and that's why Indochina became, they didn't embrace Islam through Futuhat. They embraced it because they saw that Muslim merchants who went there had good values and good characters, and people started embracing Islam. And now the largest Muslim country in the world is in Indonesia. And if our community members can do the same thing, in my opinion, to be this kind of ambassadors and not to ghettoize themselves, out of fear, then we can enlighten the mainstream community in that respect, and we will be fighting it on different level, at cultural level, at the level of the values, and being assertive at the level of law enforcement, etc. And that way, our success will be much bigger. Would you agree with this assessment?
Absolutely. The Prophet Muhammad himself taught us that we have a duty towards people around us. We have to carry the message of Islam. We're ambassadors of this faith.
Yeah.
We're messengers of the messenger. So showcasing the best of Islam is something that we should do. We should reach out to, not with the intention of converting people it's just with the intention of representing truly. When you take a commitment to a specific value system, you have to represent it in the most beautiful of ways.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. And when you do that, you naturally, even enemies become friends in the long term, as the Quran teaches us.
Yeah.
Respond with kindness, with goodness. You will find that the person between you and whom there's enmity, that enmity will over time actually develop into friendship, warm friendship. So, absolutely, and I agree with that.
And there is a social law, I would say, the law of reciprocity.
Yep.
The more we expect respect from them, that they respect us, our values, our clothes, the way we act, We reciprocate, and then things change in the long run. Now, we are coming to the end of our time, so I will ask one more question, and that is, the Jewish community, not just here in Canada, but worldwide, they, when in other majority countries where they reside, they have this organization called B'nai B'rith. And then I breath collects all kinds of information, anti-Semitic incidents, etc., compile them into a kind of statistics, and then they lobby to change government policies. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church also, I found out, has a special organ within the church, within each diocese, where they collect that kind of information if it affects the Catholic community negatively. You are an imam, and you deal with the imams of other masajid and in the Muslim community. Is there any kind of organization in the making, or it already exists, that can do similar things here in Canada?
Yeah, so I'd like to think that the Imam Council is a good place to start. You have the main representatives of the Muslim community coming together, and they discuss, you know, similar ideas. How can we create a united body that is able to keep track of these numbers? And I'd like to think, at least in Canada, we have the National Council of Canadian Muslims, the NCCM, which, that's exactly what they do in Canada. In the US, we have CARE that does that. CARE US that does a great job of advocating and keeping track of those statistics and advocating on the policy level for the most part, right? But on a global level, it's just the Muslim community is not a couple, you know, million globally. We're talking about 2 billion people in the world. We're talking about representation from every single country. It's very difficult to keep 2 billion people united. And there are political stakeholders that don't want 2 billion people to be united. Let's be very explicit about that. So any efforts at that unity are unfortunately defeated from both within and without because of the sheer number. But I know that, inshallah, with time, we are taught as Muslims that the key is unity. The key is unity. And unity should be used for good. وَتَعَاوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى وَلَا تَعَاوَنُوا عَلَى الْإِثْمِ وَالْعُدْوَانِ. Our unity is never and should never be designed to manipulate or to hurt or to persecute, but it's designed to do good for people, do good for our community and the communities around us. So I'd like to think that hopefully one day we're able to have that united body of representation, at least in things that harm us all and things that benefit us all, so that we can be united in seeking. You know, for that, I know there are a few groups that have tried. There's a group in the UK that has tried to do a Muslim leadership collective of bringing all the collectives together. Similar efforts have been attempted in Kuwait, in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Turkey. Turkey's doing some good work in that regard at this time. But the efforts so far have been local, like maybe 5, 6, 10 countries will come together. Gulf countries will come together. Youth leadership will come together in the Middle East. But it's time for, you know, all of these bodies to converse and talk to each other with respect and not with prejudice. And hopefully, I think something good will come from that, inshallah.
Well, inshallah. This is good. This is good that there is a move in that direction.
There is, yeah.
Always in my writings, I might have explained them to you. On community building, I had mentioned that there are some role model communities here in Canada and around the world that the Muslim communities can aspire to model. But now you added a level of complexity that I didn't pay attention to at that time. That is that there is so much diversity in the Muslim community. In every other country where they are immigrants, they are immigrants from 56 different countries, coming with different cultures and different variations in value systems. So what they can do is, you know, from that country, at least from the same country, if they are united and have a common purpose, they can do a lot of good. Mm-hmm. And then if there is an umbrella group like the Imam Council, perhaps, and they can provide the kind of leadership for it, then there is a lot of hope for that. Our time is up. I would have liked to continue this, but I think people, I had asked them only to be there for half an hour or so, and I'm not sure how many people are listening, but this program will be replayed and then posted on a YouTube channel, so it It is going to stay, and we will promote it so more and more people see it and have the benefit of all the gems that you shared here with us. So thank you very much. Do you have a last message to the viewers?
Yeah, my last message to people who are watching is don't lose yourself in an attempt to, you know, appeal to any specific narrative or any specific philosophy or viewpoint. You don't have to lose who you are to be part of a place or a space. And a table that is not going to allow you to sit, unless you change who you are, you change your name, your attire, your viewpoint, is not a table worth sitting at. A conversation that does not respect your presence is not a conversation worth your time or attention. And we need to be very, very firm about holding on to our identity, right? So I make it a case that, you know, when I'm in the community, representing my community to other communities, I don't wear a suit all the time or a tie or, you know, typical, what's typically constructed as Western clothing. You know, I try my best to wear something that is, you know, respectful, but also represents where I come from. Because what happens when everybody who's representing the community, who's got even a little bit of eloquence, a little bit of, you know, influence, however small, if they start appealing to, you know, Western notions of power, Western notions of, you know, of language and modes of thinking, then have you really done your best to represent your community in the best of way? These are good questions. And there are times where you should wear, and it's a big, but in general, don't lose who you are for anybody. Nobody's worth it. Nobody in this world is worth losing who you are for. Just wanted to say.
And especially in Canada, where the state policy is a cultural mosaic. It's not a melting pot. You don't need to melt into in order to blend with it. Here you can keep your identity and enrich the mosaic.
Yeah. Theoretically, at least.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time. And the viewers, thank you very much. Until our next program, hopefully next week. I hope you found this very useful. And I hope you will share it on your social media so that other people can hear also and find out about it. There were a lot of important things that were, you know, we discussed today, and I hope it will benefit everybody. So thank you very much. And if you will stay for a minute, I will just go off the air and then we'll take it.
Sure.